everybody, and welcome back again to another episode of the DistressPro.com professional podcast series. If you can hear it in my voice a little bit this week, I've got just the slightest cold. But I wanted to make this recording for you, because very recently I had a writer for DistressPro.com introduced me to someone who I'm going to introduce you to in a minute, that a man who has a very interesting business. And I started thinking about the different ways that what he offers could be used to do some more creative deals in the distressed asset space. And so we got to talking, and anyway, Tim Houghton, who's my one of our writers, introduced me to Dwayne Ortega of BestTransactionFunding.com. And so I've got him on the line today. Welcome, Dwayne.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And I'm going to grill Dwayne on all the different ways that we can use transactional funding. So it's BestTransactionFunding.com. And we're going to get into it here in a minute. But Dwayne, I like to open this up usually with some background so people kind of know who we're talking to. So why don't we start with, in case people don't know, why don't we start with what transaction funding is, and then we'll kind of work backwards how you got into it.
Sure. Transaction funding is basically funding for investors who want to wholesale properties or other types of assets. So it's funding so that they can buy the property or the assets and then sell it for a huge profit. So that's what transactional funding is in a nutshell, and we can get into it later if you wish. But my background is I've been investing in real estate basically since the year 2000. I've done almost everything. I've been a landlord mainly, and I've also built some houses during the gold rush days between 2003 to 2006. Mm-hmm. I've also owned land. I've gotten stuck with some properties during 2007 through 2009.
Join the club.
Thank you. I'm part of the exclusive club that nobody belongs to except for us. Right.
Right.
And while I was doing that part-time, and I had a full-time IT professional job belonging to the financial sector company, and during the financial meltdown 2008 to 2009, I was part of the layoffs during that round.
Wow.
So since then, since I've dabbled in real estate part-time since the year 2000, I decided to make it a full-time effort on my part, and ever since then I got into short sales for properties and real estate, and with that I got into transactional funding.
Hmm. So the path was you had a good career going, and you were also doing a lot of investing on your own account for a while. So you get spit out of the bust, and you just dove full-time into investing?
That's correct. Right. That was what I've known, and that was my passion, so it made sense.
Right. So how did it emerge? How did the transaction funding emerge from your investment background? Tell us a little bit about that piece of it.
I was going into short sales during that time, 2009. Short sales was a pretty hot market there, and I had a partner that I was doing a deal with, and he was complaining about his transactional funding guy, and I inquired, like, what is transactional funding? Then he told me, and I said, sounds interesting. I mean, are you looking for any other people to fund you? And he said, not really. Why? I said, because, you know, what can I fund you? And 7 days later, we closed.
Nice.
So it happened just like that. And, you know, it was a win-win. He realized his profits, I realized my profits, all in the same day. And it was a good business to go into, and I decided to go into it full time.
Wow. So you were smart enough to take a little money off the table as you went through the boom, it sounds like.
Yes. You know, there were some that I've lost and some that I've won, but generally I've had some I won enough to start off the
right.
to start the transactional funding business.
Right, right. Well, that's great. And so how do you I want to get into more of the nitty-gritty about the transactional funding in just one second, but just so we understand it, are the funding that you do today, is it all personal funds, or are you using private money, or what? Just people have kind of a broad picture of how that works. How are you funding all the deals that you're doing today?
It's both personal and private funds from other investors.
Okay. And bank funding, or is it all pretty much all private money?
Private money.
Private money. Okay, great. So, well, that's cool. Thanks for bringing us up to speed. So now here you've been full-time transactional funding for the last few years. I know you've got a busy office over there. And just tell me a little bit, if you would, about what types of deals you can do with transactional funding. What are you seeing out there? Or what are you funding?
Yeah, the typical deal is a short sale deal. So, for example, the most recent deal we had was that there was a short sale for, I don't remember the exact figures, but let's say it's $200,000 that the, oh, by the way, I want to get some terms defined so when I start talking, you and your audience can follow.
Great, let's do that.
In the short sale world, there are three acronyms that we continually banter about. And those are A, B, and C parties. The A party is the seller, okay, of a property. The B party is the investor, which is, I believe, your audience or my customers.
Yep.
As well. They're the B investors. They're looking to buy A's property and sell it. And the buyers from the B investors would be called the C party. So
okay.
A, again, is the seller, the B is the investor, and C is the buyer or the end buyer.
Okay.
Okay. So in a typical transaction, A is the seller, and he's in distress. His property is distressed, and he's late, and he wants to do a short sale, or he can't sell his house, and the B investor does his job and actually has the A investor contact him for help. The B investor, who would want to buy the property from the A seller, would negotiate with the bank and negotiate a short sale amount. So let's say the house was worth $300,000, or at least they had a mortgage for $300,000 from the bank. If B investor does his job properly, he would discount that mortgage and note to, let's say, $200,000. Okay, and let's say the fair market value of that house is $275,000. Okay, so then if he negotiates successfully, let's say, at $200,000, and then he sells to the CN buyer at $250,000, and the market value is at $275,000, and he executes this and coordinates this and engineers this so that it occurs on the same day, then everybody would win. The A seller would win because he gets out of the distressed property. The bank would win because they get a non-performing asset off their books.
Yep.
The CN buyer would win since they have built-in equity. They bought it for $250,000. The market value is $275,000. And the B investor would win, of course, because he did the work and he did the coordination and he gets paid the most.
Right.
So this is a typical short sale scenario. Now, where does transactional funding come in? It comes in on the buy. So on the AB buy, meaning when A sells to B for $200,000, the transactional funding funds, we provide $200,000 for the AB closing.
Right. Okay.
Okay, and then when the BC closing occurs on that same day, later that day, for example, for, let's say, $250,000, CN buyer has either cash or mortgage money. They would take us out. the 200 plus our fees, and then the rest would be given to the B investor.
Right. Okay. So I got a pretty good understanding of that. I hope the audience is able to follow along with that. But we do a transcript on this, so if you need to read through it a couple of times to understand what Dwayne just said, we will have that transcript available for you. So it's interesting. You know, obviously there's been a lot of talk about short sales out there for a while, and I've heard different things about that. There are, you know, there's various challenges that you can run into and that sort of thing. And tell us a little bit about what that looks like. I know that there are some restrictions. Something about you can only be an LLC, or there's some other. Tell us about some of the restrictions or pitfalls that you've got to avoid if you're the B party there.
Yes, you brought up a good point. As the B investor, transactional funders want to deal with investors who have experience or are a company, not necessarily a person. This is done mostly because if we deal with people, not companies, the rate we charge may be construed as usury. So we want to make sure that we're dealing with a professional company or a company who know what they're doing.
Let me just ask you to pause right there. I think most people would know, but in case they don't, can you define usury?
Usury is, in its basic terms, is charging too much for the funds to be used. So basically taking advantage of the other person.
Right. So there's federal laws against how much a lender can charge a person based on an annual rate, right? Is that more or less?
Yeah, I'm not the expert, Brett, but I believe it is based on the state.
Oh, it's state, so state by state?
It's
okay.
Not a national, yeah, it's not a national
not federal.
Threshold.
Yeah, okay.
Correct.
Yeah, I think in Massachusetts anyway, what I've heard is something like 30% or whatever it is, something like that. But I think
I believe New Jersey is about 25%.
Right. Okay. And that makes sense if you're an individual who's got a credit card. You know, you should have some protections where your credit card company can't say, okay, well, you know, your interest rate's 55% now because, you know, we don't like the looks of you anymore. But when it comes to the reason you have to be a business, when it comes to business, we assume that you're a big boy and that we know that you're using this funding to make a profit, and it's part of your business. And so for those reasons, it's between you and your lender, whatever you need, you know, however it works out. Right? Does that sum it up?
That's correct. That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And our rates are, by the way, it's 1.75% for 1 to 3 days transactional funding. This is transactional funding where we would do a back-to-back, meaning it's a quick turn, and we don't need it to extend beyond that point.
So 1.75%. So if I'm going to close something and I arrange a deal and I'm going to close in 24 to 72 hours, basically, if I'm thinking about this as the B party, I want to make sure that I'm building in, you know, on my margin, I'm building in 1.75% for the funding in order to get the deal
done.
Yeah.
Correct. So, for example, the previous example of 200,000, it would be 3,500.
Right. Which seems very reasonable if you're someone who doesn't have a couple hundred thousand dollars hanging around to flip a thing, then, you know, $3,500 for whatever, you know, margin you're going to build into that is actually pretty good. I mean, I don't know who else would give you money like that for that kind of a transaction.
Yeah, no traditional bank would really lend that kind of money for 1 to 3 days, and hard money, they would charge you points up front. So transactional funding does not really charge any points up front, maybe a processing fee. We charge a $395 processing fee up front. But that's
$395.
Correct. And that's peanuts compared to, I don't know, 4 to 6 points up front from a hard money lender, which doesn't really make any sense.
Oh, sure. I mean, a lot of the hard money guys that I know now are at least 6 points, and your rates are in the teens, and you're tying up a lot of your other assets as collateral. There's a lot to it.
Yes. And also, Brett, I wanted to mention the other type of program we have is called extended transactional funding, where we can go out to up to 40 days. For transactional funding. Now, what is the difference, basically, between extended transactional funding and back-to-back transactional funding? The main difference is that there's two main differences. In the scenario that I provided earlier, you have the end buyer already in place. You would also have the same scenario in the extended transactional funding. We would require that the end buyer is already in place. However, one of the biggest differences is that the end buyer's funds in a back-to-back scenario, the end buyer's funds must be in the same escrow account as our fund, okay, before we transact. So we want to make sure that $250,000 is already there, then we wire our funds to $200,000, then we close the AB, then the BC. Now, in an extended transactional funding scenario, that $250,000 is not there. So we take on more risk. That $250,000 will be there within the next 40 days or whatever time period the client wants within the 40 days.
So I want to talk about some of the nitty-gritty details like that, but what I'd like to do is back up just a little bit and talk about some use cases for the money. Because I know offline you and I have had an opportunity to talk a little bit, and a lot of my audience is interested in or actively engaged in notes and buying and selling notes and pursuing notes and this sort of thing. And you had a very interesting story, and we came up with, between the two of us, a couple of, I'll use it again, use cases for the money. But I wonder, you told a story about a transaction on a note sourced from a local bank that I wonder if you could walk my audience through that. What happened and how it worked.
Sure. A B investor approached me to see if I wanted to fund a hybrid transaction. So instead of buying the property from A's bank, A seller's bank, and then selling it to C end buyer, what the B investor wanted to do was to buy the note from a local bank, not one of the big banks such as Bank of America or Chase.
Right, which is great. I don't mean to interrupt you, but what I talk about a lot is that if you're going out after smaller, single notes like that, don't call Bank of America, don't call Chase. They're not talking to you about selling you, independent investor, one or two or three notes. It's not even worth their time to have the conversation. So if you're going to go after anything like this, don't do it with Deutsche Bank. Don't do it with Bank of America. Do it with the Bank of New Jersey or, Eastern Bank or whatever. And so I just wanted to throw that out there up front. I appreciate you mentioning that it was a local bank and not B of A or someone like that.
That's definitely an important point. Thanks for emphasizing that. So, again, it's a local bank. He wanted me to fund the purchase of the note. So we did, and the details of the transaction was as follows. So he coordinated two closings on the same day. So let's say it's May 21st.
Yeah.
He told the bank, A seller's bank, that he's going to buy the note on the 21st. And then he had a contract with the CN buyer saying that he's going to sell the property to him on the 21st. Okay? On the day of the closing, we provided the funds to buy the note, let's say the $200,000 again. So we provided $200,000 to buy the note, all right, and then the end buyer was also there on that day to buy the property. So what the B investor did was he bought the note, he approved the short sale for the A seller.
Right, off the face of it. So it's a short sale in terms of on the face of the note, but it's not a short sale compared to what. I just want to make sure people understand there's a profit here. It's not a short sale compared to what he's acquired the note for. It's short on what the unpaid balance is on the thing.
Right, from the original mortgagor, which is the A seller.
Right.
Correct.
Right.
It's short on his note.
Right.
So let's say
not short on what your investor bought it at, because that, you know, we're not running around out there trying to lose money. Right?
Right.
It's,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. For simplicity's sake, we can use the same example. So let's say this note was $300,000. He negotiated to buy the note from the bank for $200,000. Okay? And he's going to sell it to the end buyer, the property, at $250,000. And the market value is $275,000.
Right.
Okay. So he bought the note short from the bank from $300,000 to $200,000. Approved the short sale, and then, of course, executed the A-B closing, which is when the seller, A, and the bank approve everything to be sold to the B investor. And then he turns around the same day. He sells the property to the C-end buyer for $250,000.
Right.
And the C-end buyer is either cash or has a mortgage. His funds are in the escrow account. And then the transactional funding folks, us, we get paid off with our fees, and the balance goes to the B investor.
Wow. So, you know, I'm thinking here as you're talking, there's a few different ways, you know, you could approach that, or you could find, I'm thinking about, you know, sourcing these deals, or, you know, where do these deals come from? And you know, one way is you... Yeah, and I haven't done any of these deals. You and I having this conversation is the first time I've ever heard of somebody using that kind of funding and doing, you know, this kind of a deal. And I've been in the business for a little while and you know, done a fair share of deals. So, so I'm looking at that and I say, well, how would I find these deals? And I guess one way is, depending on the state that you're in or whatever, you see the foreclosure notices, you see which bank is, you know, foreclosing. You know, at that point it might be a little bit late. You know, but if you see that it's a local bank, you could go in, you know, by approaching the owner, or you could go in by approaching the bank, depending on, you know, how that works. I guess another way that you could do it is if you have a relationship with a local banker who has a small portfolio of these things, that you could just talk to them about what notes they have and who's trying to do a short sale and who's trying to get out, and you could source them that way. You know, I guess the third way would be your I was going to say you could do, you know, your traditional sort of short sale marketing where, you know, you're offering help and then people contact you. But I think a lot of times what you're going to run into with that is that because so many notes are written, so many loans are held with the biggest banks, and this sort of process that we're talking about is just not going to fly with the big banks. So, you know, I think it's really going to come back down to relationships with some of your local bankers if you're going to source stuff like that. Did I cut you off in the middle of something?
No. I would agree with what you just said.
Yeah. So, and you and I were also talking a little bit about maybe some other use cases on this where, you know, how else would we – what are some of the other reasons that we would want to use transactional funding for a note? You want to talk about some of those?
Sure. Essentially, it's the same reason as partially the same reason as why you would want to use transactional funding. Part of the benefit of using transactional funding is for the privacy on your first deal, the AB deal.
Right.
Okay, so the same thing would go for notes. Let's say you don't want your C end buyer of your note or property to know, you know, how much you're making, let's say, for the first buy and also your markup on the second, then you would do two separate transactions. Transactional funding actually enables you to do two separate transactions because of the separate funds.
Right.
Two separate funds, two separate closings, two separate, you know, titles to be used there. And another, I would say another reason would be is privacy as well. You don't want to reveal your source to your end buyer because you want to do more deals with that source and to possibly sell it to different C end buyers, not only the your usual C end buyer.
Right.
That's what I think that's the what I can think of off the top of my head.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, the main thing is, or one of the big benefits of it is, you don't want to be showing your whole hand as an investor. You know, you don't need to show where you're, if you can avoid it. You know, it'd be better not to show where you're sourcing everything, what you're paying for it, how much you're making on it. You know, if I'm a broker and I've got an agreement, a note broker, and I've got an agreement, you know, for a couple of points to sell a thing, well, that's between, you know, me and the seller, and they're gonna pay me out of that, and that's kind of private. But if I'm gonna negotiate a price and then sell on a note or a handful of notes or whatever it is, and I'm gonna then sell those to one or more end buyers, well, I don't necessarily, I don't need them to know that I'm not making 2 points, that I'm making 10. So I think, you know, that that's really depending on the size of the transactions that you're doing, I think, you know, that's really a big benefit there. So I want to talk a little bit about, and you started to talk about it, but it lay out for us one more time the difference between your 1 to 3 day and your 40 day, not only the costs and the terms and the function, but also sort of a little bit more about, I know you have some rules about where the money is and when it's there and that kind of a thing. Can you walk us through that?
Sure. Well, the main difference between, from our perspective, from international funding perspective, is that for a back-to-back transaction, the 1 to 3 days, the money from the end buyer, the C end buyer, whether it's cash or mortgage, must be with the title company or the closing agent, either the title company or attorney, depending on the state you're in.
Yep.
Before we wire our funds to make sure that this is going to close. So in the scenario that I provided before, where we would fund $200,000 and the CN buyer would buy for $250,000, we would make sure that the $250,000 would be in the escrow account first before we mm-hmm. buy our $200,000. Not saying that, you know, the end buyer should close first. We just want to make sure that the end buyers would close, because it has happened to us before where there was no money there and it's not worth it to wire the funds. It's not closing because there's no money. So in a back-to-back transaction, money has to be there first in the escrow account, and then we would wire our fund. Okay? And then in an extended transactional funding scenario, the main difference is, from a funding perspective, is that the end buyer is not going to close until X amount of days later, up to 40 days.
Okay.
Okay? So us as funders, we would take a big risk. We would be acting like a bank or a hard money lender, actually, mm-hmm. funding the property, the purchase of the property, the AB closing. However, we would insure against that, of course, asking for proof of that the transaction has a C end buyer in the end. they have a commitment letter or they have the proof of funds if it's cash. We want to make sure that the CN buyer is there. So it's basically the same except for the funds of when the funds arrive to the escrow account.
So in my in the states that I operate in, typically for this kind of thing, we would there's an offer to purchase with earnest money, usually, if we're talking about the C buyer, right? So they've got an offer to purchase with some earnest money. Then we go to a purchase and sale agreement after that. And some states cut, you know, that second step out. And at the purchase and sale, you take a more significant deposit, but there's still, you know, there might be a financing contingency left in there or something like that. Will you fund something that's got a financing contingency hanging out there?
Financing contingency meaning
the C buyer's got an agreement to close, they have they're approved or whatever, but we don't have a commitment letter yet. Or you need the commitment letter before you approve.
We need a commitment letter or a fully full doc approval of the buyer for a property, not necessarily the property.
Yep.
If you know what I mean, we need to make sure that the buyer, if he's financing it or mortgaging it, he's fully qualified and can buy up to a certain amount.
Okay. Okay. And so you do the 1 to 3, you do up to 40. Are there other terms that you'll do?
Such as?
30, 60, 90 day.
Okay, yeah. At this point, we're only going to do up to 40, probably max 45 days.
Okay.
Not sure about 90 days because I don't know how that is worth it for the B investor. Mm. The reason why is when you get up to 90 days, you're talking at least 20% interest, which is you might as well go either hard money or not do the deal because there's not enough profit for anybody.
Right, right. So a lot of our folks, you know, they could be wondering. Sometimes when you're doing these deals, especially with the banks, you need to show some proof of funds that you're able to do these deals before you close. Do you offer that sort of thing?
Yes, we offer two types of products. Actually, we offer a free proof of funds letter through our website, besttransactionfunding.com.
Yep.
We offer a free POF. You can go to the POF tab there and get it yourself. And so that one's for free. Okay. We would fund you as long as it's a back-to-back transaction or an extended transaction or funding transaction. And there's also, you know, if that is not enough and you need a bank statement, which is why we created this product, because our customers wanted a bank statement.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's not really... It's not something that we originally intended to do, but if our customers need it, fine. And it's not really we break even with it. It's not even profitable for us, but we do provide it for a fee. For $495, we provide up to $500,000 verification of deposit, which is a available balance statement from the bank that is hand stamped by a bank officer or a bank manager in our local branch here. So, we provide that within the last 30 days, and, you know, people have been taking us up on it. Again, due to the nature of our business, we may or may not have those funds at that specific time that you requested. So if that's the case, we would refund your funds. But
right.
We do offer that as an option should you need it.
And so what's a good deal size for you?
A good deal size? I would say the typical deal size for us is $200,000, typically.
Okay.
Depending
okay.
on the state.
So it's a lot of one-offs, a lot of individual, we're not talking about bulk, we're not talking about, you know, we're talking about small packages or single assets, typically.
Oh, we are actually talking about single properties, typically.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Well, I'm just thinking, okay, so of course my head is going in a million directions. I'm thinking, okay, so I find somebody who's got a bank, who's got a small pool, and they and I know that I have buyers, and maybe there's more than one end buyer, and so I'm just kind of thinking about through all the different options, and maybe what we need to do is if you and I spend a little time together offline, we can bang our heads together and see what other sorts of how else your money can be used for some of the sort of creative transactions. I wanted to mention one thing. I know that you have offered a special a discount to distresspro.com listeners on your is it on the fee? Is that the discount that you're giving?
Sure. Yeah,
did you say you can do $100 off the $395 or something like that? Is that? I know we talked about it briefly.
Yes, yes, we are offering that special for a limited time. We are providing $100 off the processing fee for Distress Pro listeners.
Okay.
So
cool.
If you go to our website, actually, there is if you apply for funding. Should you be ready at that time, there is a tab called the Funding Request tab, and if you scroll down at one of those fields, it'll ask for a coupon code, and you could type in the coupon code for the $100 off, and it would expire in the next 2 months. So by July, today is May 3rd, by July 3rd, it expires.
Okay.
So the coupon code would be DP100OFF, and that is Distress Pro $100 off. So again, that's Distress Pro DP100OFF.
Cool.
If you put that in the coupon code under the funding request, we would certainly honor that within the next 2 months.
Okay, that's great. I really appreciate that. I think is there anything that we didn't cover today that you wanted to talk about?
Let me see. I'm not sure if you mentioned this, but we're nationwide. We fund through all 50 states, and again, states vary as far as their funding amounts. So our typical deal here in the Northeast is around 200. However, in the Midwest, it could be as low as 14,000, which is 12,000 was my lowest deal, which is kind of funny.
Right.
And 900,000 something was our largest deal thus far.
Right.
And that's about it. I just wanted
so
to
sort of up to a million is a good deal size for you in all 50 states.
Yeah, the anything above 500,000 is on a case by case.
Yep.
But up to 500,000 we should be able to fund it depending on of course our schedule and the funds being taken out.
Great. And so people can find you at besttransactionfunding.com, and if they want to save $100 until July 3rd, they can enter the coupon code again, which was D. Can you say it for me?
DP, as in Distress Pro,
yep.
100OFF.
Cool. Well, I really appreciate you being on today, Dwayne, and I think that there's a lot of different opportunities here for some of the smaller, transactions, and I hope that as, in the coming months, you and I can maybe figure out some other ways to do some more creative deals. So I really appreciate you coming on and laying this whole thing out.
Thank you for having me. It was fun, and I'm looking forward to doing deals with you and your listeners.
Okay, my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Dwayne. Bye-bye.